Welcome to Yarns at Yin Hu, a podcast about the fiber arts and other post-apocalyptic skills. Episode 303, poems 11 to 20 of the 100 Days Project. Today is Wednesday, December 14th. It's day 20 of my 100 Days Project, which I began on November 26th, Black Friday, and I'm continuing through March 5th. Each day I pull a book of poetry from my collection at home and read a poem, usually more than one. Last night I read most of the book that I had selected for yesterday, and I've picked some poems to share with you on this podcast episode. This is not a regular episode. It's a special episode made possible by my supporters on Ko-Fi. Thank you so much. If you are interested in becoming a supporting member or buying me a cup of coffee on Ko-Fi, the link to that is available from my Instagram page. I have a link tree set up with links to various things that I talk about in the podcast. So I'll be interspersing these special episodes in with my regular episodes where I talk about my knitting and other projects. I received quite a bit of positive feedback regarding the special episode I posted last with a reading of poems 1 through 10. I mentioned being the recipient of some poetry postcards from Ted Kooser, and I received this wonderful message on my website as a comment from Jane Wolfe. She's Prairie Poet on Ravelry. Probably a lot of you listeners will be familiar with Jane. She responds to my wonder that I received postcards from Ted Kooser for a few years and then no more. She writes, "Hello, Sarah. I am enjoying your poetry reading project. I'm writing a note about Ted Kooser's Valentine mailing list. I also signed up for the Valentine mailing list at a poetry reading he gave in Lincoln after he was named the U.S. Poet Laureate. The last postcard I received is dated 2007 and notes that it is number 22 and the last of the series. The poem on that card is titled The Paper Boat. In 2008, the University of Nebraska Press published Valentine's, a limited edition book of all the Valentine poems, illustrated with pen and ink drawings by Robert Hanna. I have a signed copy and it is a beautiful little book. In the introduction to the book, Kooser describes how the Valentine mailing list originated. By 2007, his list included around 2,600 names, and printing and postage costs ran into the hundreds of dollars, so he discontinued this tradition. I thought you and other poetry fans might enjoy this information. Thank you for such a thoughtful podcast." Thank you, Jane, for your note. That was very kind and nice to have a bit more of a glimpse into that poetry project. The first poem I'll share with you is by poet Carolyn Forché. I was very privileged to be able to hear her read and speak at the Geraldine R. Dodge Poetry Festival this fall. The poem I'm reading is from a book called Blue Hour. I have a beautiful hardback copy of this volume. And it's a collection of quite elusive, evocative poems. The one I'm sharing with you was written in Beirut in the winter of 1983. It's titled Writing Kept Hidden. The black fire of ink on paper took hold of their souls, incorporeal fire. There was no protection this fire couldn't touch, nor darkness, nor a moment. It lasted as long as a dream. It was no dream. Heteroglossia of nervous shortwave, cloud of blown walls. In the barracks, those who had sketched themselves in coal and smoke became coal and smoke. And the living remained, linking unknown things to the known. Residue, scapular, matchlight, name on a tongue. Then for an hour the war slept, and rain filled the cisterns with silence. Our windows faced east, and on August evenings, the sky was a blue, no longer spoken. The next poem is a short one by Charles Simic from his book, The Voice at 3 a.m., Selected Late and New Poems. And this one is called Lost Glove. Here is a woman's black glove. It ought to mean something. A thoughtful stranger left it on the red mailbox at the corner. 3 days the sky was troubled. Then today a few snowflakes fell on the glove, which someone in the meantime had turned over so that its fingers could close a little. Not yet a fist. So I waited, with the night coming. Something told me not to move. Here, where flames rise from trash barrels, and the homeless sleep standing up. This next poem is by E.J. Vega. He was born in Cuba and was educated in Brooklyn and at Columbia University. He's part of this anthology I have called Paper Dance, 55 Latino Poets, which is a great way to get to know a wide variety of poets. There are some that are very frequently anthologized and others like E.J. Vega, whose poetry I only know through this anthology. The poem I've selected for you is Why My Mother's Teeth Remained in Cuba. The great Don Pepe Jardín carried his middle daughter downhill, writhing in pain, to the dentist, who was also the village blacksmith. Saving the tooth will cost 2 pesos, said the dentist, while shaping hot steel rods into horseshoes. To extract, 1. The great Don readjusted the brim of his fedora, gazed up at the mountains of his daughter's birth, and at his 30,000 acres of coffee beans that at times tumbled to the earth like bright gumdrops. Raising one finger to heaven, he faced the dentist, who wiped burn-scarred hands on a leather apron and strapped the girl to an armchair. Afa Michael Weaver is the author of The Plum Flower Dance, poems 1985 to 2005. He is an elder in the group Cave Canem, which is a collection of poets who assembled, I think, in the 1980s to address the underrepresentation of Black writers in poetry. And so he's been very influential as both a poet and a professor of poetry. And he was the first African-American poet to hold the poet-in-residence position at Bucknell University. Weaver does a lot of reimagining and revisioning with his poems in this collection. The one I'm going to read to you is called Provincetown. It's a section of a larger poem titled New England. And it begins with a passage. I'm not sure where the passage is from. It's not attributed. But it reads, "At night a voice lends its enchantment, and New England is owned by the pondering dead." So this is the section called Provincetown. And listeners will know that Provincetown holds a special place in my heart. So, of course, I want to know what Michael Weaver has to write about it. "Ambling through the Cape, we begin at Buzzard's Bay, stopping in the full moon to play with an itinerant retriever, watching his wet body melt in the trail of moonlight, linking the beach to the gods. He loses the wood floating and threatens to drown himself with determination in the black water until we throw more flotsam and he yelps to celebrate the deception, the call away from the dead end of duty that swallowed men and made women suck and choke on the delicate lace of loneliness. Driving on, the wail of ocean is hushed by the towering woods until we reach the point, the first landing of Puritans where Cook assembled his thespians in Mary Vorse's old wharf. Looking out the window, dreaming of some revival, some Greek organic seed to deify the American soul, as O'Neill carved his dark emperor. We watch for contented artists who sign bloodless treaties with despair. At night, bright ships sail the sky, pushed on by the songs of ghosts given back by history's rituals for an eternal voyage back to love." I have known Robert Haas primarily as a translator. He's done amazing translations of Milos and also of Japanese haiku. The book I pulled off the shelf this week is his Human Wishes, and it contains quite a few prose poems. Prose poems have a lot in common with other types of poetry. They're often quite dense. They deliver images, not necessarily story. But in a prose poem, the major unit of delivery is the sentence as opposed to the line. And prose poems typically appear like big blocks of text on the page. For this reason, some lovers of poetry don't really enjoy them, because one of the things about reading poetry is that you are either attracted or you find distasteful, or, you know, you're sort of neutral about the architecture of the poem. The way it looks on the page could be speaking to you even before you can read a single word. One of the very interesting exercises I've done with my students when we have a poetry unit is to give them a poetry anthology and say, okay, we're going to have a conversation about this book, but I don't want you to read any of the poems. I just want you to flip through and look at them like they're pictures. And tell me about the ones that attract you and the ones that repulse you. And that kind of begins our conversation about what makes poetry and what a good entry point might be. So I quite enjoy prose poems. I like that blockiness on the page, and I come to expect something a little bit different than poetry that's delivered in lines. This is Quartet from a collection titled Human Wishes. The two couples having dinner on Saturday night, it is late fall, are in their late 30s and stylish, but not lavishly so. The main course is French, loin of pork probably, with a North African accent, and very good. The dessert will be sweet and fresh, having to do with cream and berries. It is early fall, and it feels like a course. It is that substantial. They are interestingly employed a professor of French, let's say, the assistant curator of a film at a museum, a research director for a labor union, a psychologist, a journalist, a sculptor, an astronomer, etc. One of them believes that after death there is nothing, that our knowledge of this is a fluke or a joke, like knocking on doors as children sometimes do, and then disappearing, so that the pleasure has to be in imagining the dismay of the person who finds the entryway empty. Another believes dimly and from time to time, not in heaven exactly, but in a place where the dead can meet and talk quietly, where losses are made good. Another believes in the transmigration of souls, not the cosmic reform school of Indian religion, but an unplanned passage, rather like life in its mixture of randomness and affinity. The fourth believes in ghosts, or has felt that consciousness might take longer to perish than the body and linger sometimes as a spectral and unfinished grief, or unfinished happiness, if it doesn't come to the same thing. They're not talking about this. They are talking about high school. Children travel politics. They know more or less who is paying for their meal. For people, the women with soft breasts, the men with soft, ropey, external genitals. In chairs, talking. It is probably the third Saturday in September. Maybe they have had melon or a poached pear. The hostess, a solid, placid woman with unusually large knuckles and a good amateur soprano voice, has begun to pour coffee into cream-colored cups. This next poem is from a collection titled Lead Belly by Tayahimba Jess. It is a collection of poems that reimagines the life of Lead Belly, born Huddy Ledbetter in Caddo County, Louisiana in 1888. The collection is written from many different voices, including Leadbelly's mother and father, various women in his life. There are, you know, many music references, place references. In the back, there is a timeline of Leadbelly's life, which helps to kind of bring context to the poems, and it's, if you're a music lover, it's really a lot of fun to read, but I think its appeal isn't limited to music lovers. I'm going to read one of the early works in the book called Sally Ledbetter, A Mother's Hymn. When the black boy climbs out of my womb, how to peel dynamite from his bones. How to strip tornadoes hum from his ears, how to weed graveyard from his garden of tongue. What rainbow of prayer to pull between teeth, how to blind him from liquor's sun of stupor, how to sow whisper into his hurricane of hips. What blizzard of plea to freeze his tremor of feet, how to lift him from streetlight blaze. Which revengeful breast fed him this poison? Which breast gilded his mouth with song? This next poem is by Hayden Carruth in a book titled Scrambled Eggs and Whiskey. This is a villanelle. I don't read a great deal of formal poetry in forms. But here's one. It's a villanelle. It has a certain configuration of rhythm and rhyme that you'll pick up on as I read. This is Saturday at the Border. Here I am writing my first villanelle, at 71 and feeling old and tired. "Hey, Pops, why don't you just give us the old death knell?" And writing it, what's more, on the rim of hell, in blazing Arizona, when all I desired was north and solitude and not a villanelle. Working from memory and not remembering well how many stanzas and in what order, wired on Mexican coffee, seeing the death knell of sun's salvos upon these hills, that yell bloody murder silently to the much admired dead blue sky. One wonders if a villanelle can do the job. Yes, old men now must tell our young world how these bigots and these retired bankers of Arizona are ringing the death knell for all of us, how ideologies compel children to violence. Artifice acquired for its own sake is war. Frail villanelle, have you this power? And I must go and sell myself? Wow, they say, and cool, this hired old poetry guy with his spaced out death knell. Ah, far from home and God knows not much fired by thoughts of when he thought he was inspired. He writes by writing what he must. Death knell is what he's found in his first villanelle. Right, so I said I don't read a lot of formal poetry, and yet here are two formal poems in a row. This next one is a poem by Ellen Bryant Voigt. It's from her collection Kyrie. It has to do with the influenza epidemic of 1918, and it's a series of blank verse sonnets. So it's not the kind of sonnet that you had to memorize the lines and the iambic pentameter and all of that of high school. This is a bit looser and more expansive kind of a sonnet. And like in the Leadbelly collection, Ellen Bryant Voigt uses many different voices and perspectives in order to give a picture of the pandemic and wartime, and just there's a lot of layers to this collection. They're not numbered or anything. They just sort of fall one after the other in a few different sections. So this is near the end of the collection. Once the world had had its fill of war in a secret wood as the countryside lay stunned at the hour of the wolf and the vole in a railroad car, the generals met and put their weapons down. Like spring it was as word passed over all the pocked and riven ground and underground. Now the nation sat in a gilded hall, dividing what they'd keep of what they'd won. And so the armies could be done with war, and soldiers trickled home to study peace. But the old gardens grew a tough new weed, and the old lives didn't fit as they had before, and where there'd been the dream, a stranger's face, and where there'd been the war, an empty sleeve. Last night, I read almost this entire book. It's one of my absolute favorites. It's called What the Living Do by Marie Howe. She's such an incredible poet. She's such a great teacher of poetry. To listen to her talk about the writer's life and what it means to really give meaning to your life by writing poetry is just an amazing experience. Her brother died of AIDS, and she wanted to write about him, was struggling to write about him, and it was just falling flat. And she talked about, in a sort of conversation about poetry like you sometimes hear at the Dodge Festival, that she had a professor or a poetry mentor who said, you know, you don't need to tell us how much you love your brother or you miss him or how wonderful he was. Just describe him exactly as he was. Just go to the very detail of his life. And the reader, the listener will know, you know, will love him just as you did, if you can just get that specificity. And so she sort of applied those principles to many of the poems in this collection. The one I'm going to read to you is called The Gate. I had no idea that the gate I would step through to finally enter this world would be the space my brother's body made. He was a little taller than me, a young man, but grown, himself by then, done at 28, having folded every sheet, rinsed every glass he would ever rinse under the cold and running water. "This is what you have been waiting for," he used to say to me. And I'd say, "What?" And he'd say, "This," holding up my cheese and mustard sandwich. And I'd say, "What?" And he'd say, "This," sort of looking around. Finally is a poem from Raoul Schrott in a collection called The Desert of Lop. This is described as a novella with 101 chapters. So it definitely goes back to that idea of the prose poem and things building one on another, but not the way you would necessarily get in a novel, because it's much more imagistic and is just a smattering or suggestion of story. This is piece number 31. Each piece is numbered. Some are shorter, some are longer, and they focus on this character, Raoul Luper, and also Arlette, the love interest. 31. In the Gilf Kebir, I once saw time. It was a kind of wheat grass, its panicle bent down. In the morning, a breeze came from the rising sun, and in the evening, from where it set. Moved by the wind, the stalk traced a complete circle in the sand, like a clock, which knows no hours. Thanks for listening, and thank you to Ko-Fi supporters for making this episode possible. I'll be back again soon with a regular episode featuring some of my usual segments.